And welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. This was our first episode, our first live show of 2022. And the gang was all there. Well, you guys won't hear Gene Bajlan in the main show. If you are patrons, Gene joined us because my entire internet connection went down and I had to do an emergency bat line call to backup producer, Mean Gene Bajlan. And he just stuck around and we had a very good conversation. So if you are not a patron and would like to hear the deeper dive that we do take, patreon.com/bitterlakepresents. Wherever you're listening to the show, there are links in the description for all of our social media and Patreon. But this show, we get to talk to our good friend who is, we just drilled with questions. And you're going to hear me apologize profusely for it. And I want to apologize one more time. See Derek Varn, who many of you know from Varn Vlog and Pop the Left, formerly on Zero Books. Originally was supposed to be on the show with us. And every week for 2 weeks after we booked it, Gene Bajlan said, "Jason, did you contact Varn?" I was like, "Oh, yeah, I'll do it." And I always forgot. And then because I tweeted something out, Varn goes, "Hey, can I be on this show?" And I was like, "Ah, you're totally supposed to be on this show." Kept forgetting. But we wanted to take a deep dive into the current state of the presidency of Pedro Castillo because Camilo is a journalist in Peru, in Lima. But he covers a lot of Latin America in general. And he had either posted an article or wrote something about, this is before the impeachment proceedings had even started, but about some news that was coming out about the Castillo administration that wasn't very positive, right? Stories of corruption. And usually the first thing we think here with our U.S. left brains is it's all propaganda. It's not real. He is just and right. And it's not real. Sometimes that is true, but we're talking about Latin America. The United States has had a foot in the ass of Latin America for some time now. So that's not outside of the realm of possibility to believe that it's not true. Or it's an over-exaggeration. We have too many examples to point to. But we do take a deep dive into what's going on currently in Peru with Pedro Castillo. The Peru Libre Socialist Party even was on the cusp of being part of the people voting him out of office. Why? I am out. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first All the Way Live 2022 edition of This is Revolution Podcast. I am your host, Jason Miles. If you are new to the show and you haven't done it already, please hit the like and subscribe button. Don't forget to hit the bell so you are always alerted whenever we go live. With the new year, we are constantly adding new programming. There's so much that we have in store. We've been talking about it a little bit, probably talk about it a little bit more tonight about some of the new shows that we have going on for the new year. But before we even get into that, I'm very excited to bring in my homie, my dog, 2022, the man of the Mau Mau Hour. He is the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. Happy New Year to everyone.
I said it's Happy New Year in Haiti.
Today, probably, yes.
Yes, as you guys can see, Pascal and I have upgraded our sets. I will be having different album covers that I love probably every episode. But this album cover behind me is one of my favorite records, and it always has looked like a madman's basement, and it still gives me chills whenever I look at it. Our next host, you know him as the greatest middle manager in Death Star history. He is the man that makes sure every stormtrooper has a cover sheet on his TPS report. He is Deep State Cuba.
Hello, everyone. Happy New Year. I do not have a Snazzy New background. My office in the Death Star is getting fumigated for Womp Rats. So they've assigned me this prisoner's quarters as an interim solution. I am not best pleased, but you know, I am only middle manager.
We're still going to make a middle manager Koopa in the Death Star shirt of you scolding the stormtrooper with the guy that has to go blow up your planet shit. Like, you have to scold him while he's blowing up the wrong planet.
You're taking an extra 1.5 seconds on the energy drawdown. You think kilojoules grow on trees?
My boss is chewing my ass. You know Vader.
Exactly. We're all under pressure to make our quarterlies.
Death Star
quarterlies. Still 200 dead Ewoks short.
Poor Varn. And coming in as a guest host, and I want to say this. When we originally had planned to do this show, our guest said, hey, maybe you should hit up Varn. And I said, great idea. Book the show. Tell everybody what's going on with the show. We get it in our calendar. Every day, Jean Bajelon, and I want to give Jean props, says in his very, very beautiful, flowery British voice, did you message Vaughn? Fuck, I forgot to do that. Every day for like 2 weeks. And on Twitter, which I don't really check anymore, Vaughn writes, oh, can I be on this? I was like, yeah. Yeah, you're supposed to be on this. And you would have had better notice and not been notified by Twitter had I not been a doucher. So I'm saying this on air, Varn. My bad. Coming all the way live from one of the coldest places I've ever been. He's everyone's favorite teacher in the Salt Lake School District. The Derek Varn.
Hi. ¿Qué onda? ¿Cómo te va? Good morning and good night.
Good morning, so, really?
Yeah, good morning. I went to sleep after I got off class today. And the antics of evil Space Dilbert has set the tone for the day. So,
well, before we bring in our very esteemed guest, our favorite South American journalist, I do want to say before I even bring him on, I feel thank you, Varn, for introducing us to Camilo, because he has been an amazing resource for us to know what's going on, in the Americas. But we made a little clip for today. Oh, where's it at? Oh! And let's play the clip. Are you guys ready?
The 51-year-old primary school teacher is now in the net. He won the promise school Peruvians.
How can ministers and politicians earn such salaries when our children have no internet, our schools are falling apart, families are begging for oxygen, homes have no water or electricity? We will rescue this country to give our families a home with dignity.
Only 5 months ago, the ascendancy of Pedro Castillo from primary school teacher to president of Peru was seen as a victory for the poor and working class and a sign of a new rising pink tide in Latin America. Less than a year in office, Castillo is facing challenges from the far-right opposition party, calling for his impeachment, as well as turmoil from within Castillo's own Peru Libre Socialist Party that until the last minute was in support of Castillo's ouster from office. Peru, a country that has seen 4 presidents in the last 3 years, has a long sordid history of corrupt leaders and congressional governments. In less than 6 months, Castillo's approval rating has dropped to its lowest point yet, a mere 25%. However, while many are unhappy with the young administration of Castillo, there is still a large contingent that want to see Castillo make good on his campaign promises and avoid giving power to what the majority of Peruvian citizens feel is a far more corrupt Congress. Will the reign of Pedro Castillo end like his predecessors in scandal and impeachment? Is the far-right and oligarchic class too powerful for Castillo and the Peru Libre Socialist Party to overcome? Is there validity in Castillo's claims that his poor lower-class campesino background is the impetus for this attempted ouster? We'll ask these questions and more. This is Revolution.
All right, without any further ado, let's bring in our guest. He is an independent journalist based in Lima, Peru, Camilo Gomez. Camilo, how are you?
I'm fine. I was still in the pre-show. I have been recently boosted, like getting my booster vaccine, and you know, I feel fine now for now. It seems like the Omicron variant is growing, but in lethality, it doesn't seem that case. Many argue that Peru has kind of developed neighborhood immunity, which means that, you know, not only the vaccines, but the percentage of population infected is very high. So hopefully that you know, like, it's just going to generate infections but not deaths as in previous waves.
Well, before we get into, I do have some vaccine and how Peru's handling COVID questions for you, but I just want to start it off by asking kind of the big question. The socialist president of Peru just stopped a coup attempt that was instigated by the far right party led by presidential challenger Keiko Fujimori. One thing that I was surprised to read was that there was opposition from within his own party, Peru Libre.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I think it is like a really interesting story. I think that like it's not necessarily that much known for the outside press is that Pedro Castillo in reality had his own I attempt to create his own party, but he, since he was unable to inscribe his own party, he ran on Peru Libre, because the likely presidential candidate and the president of the party, Vladimir Cerrón, who was a regional governor, was under an investigation for corruption. So Pedro Castillo kind of ran in the party, which he also had like difference. Like Pedro Castillo is not a Marxist-Leninist. He comes from the union movement and for the rebel teachers unions. But he's a leftist, but more heterodox than Peru Libre, who in some ways are more, and also heterodox in the modern sense, because like unlike many other parties in the left, they don't necessarily put that much emphasis on social issues. I will say, however, that the issue that in some ways connects like Peru Libre and Pedro Castillo and kind of challenge the narrative of unwokeness is that their vision of racial issues obviously do fits more on the left spectrum compared to the Latin American far right that has a much more racist framework. So that's basically it. Like in some ways Pedro Castillo is an invited in his own party. So
do we freeze?
He has some back him in the party because like he put them there, but there are other congressmen and congresswomen who are against him because like they are kind of more loyal to the leader of the party than to Pedro Castillo.
Camille, I'd like to ask you a question. Can you explain to us in our audience why the general public in Peru, even those who support Castillo, have a certain apprehension about him becoming too radical left as a political figure? Why is there, even amongst his supporters, this kind of latent paranoia about him, you know, adopting either Marxist-Leninism or becoming too hard left? Can you elaborate on the history as to why that's the case?
Yeah, I think obviously it has, some relationship with the fact that, you know, like kind of the shining path has been a kind of phantom for the left for a long time. Like the shining path and the revolutionary movement Tupac Amaru with acts of terrorism, like kind of were a sad representation of kind of left-wing dogmatism in the 80s and 90s. But I do feel also it has to do with the sense that that there was to some degree like the left has in some ways. And I think this is not necessarily, there is a narrative that puts, you know, the left has embraced the neoliberal narrative, but even market socialism in some ways have, in some ways even predates the writings about market socialism that predate, for example, Yugoslavia, you know, from the 30s. It's very curious. But this idea of trying to search a way between markets and the left, I think it's quite curious, and it exists. It has been existed for a while. It's often like when people think about kind of radical movements, people think about like the shining path or the revolution movement Tupac Amaru. In reality, there were movements prior to that, like the word, but also in a different dynamic, which not necessarily were opposed to campesinos or to social movements, but that like the guerrillas of the 60s would come in some way of more Guevara's kind of way, but their objective was to take back the land from the landowners and devolve the land to the campesinos, to the kind of who often were indigenous. So it is complex because even between that group that could be seen as very radical, there were some people that even then were very worried about attempts from within those radical groups of trying to forbid like those campesinos now with their new lands to sell, you know, to be part mm-hmm. of the market. So in some ways there was always a sense in the left that there was some need to have some markets. So, and I feel it's even complex when it came the case of China, because I feel also for some in the left, it is becoming kind of a model, even if they will disagree with the idea of the unified party. Some do see them in some ways as a model. And I feel that in that sense, it could sound strange, but the reason why the central banker, the neoliberal central banker that was before has a stay was because Peru Libre kind of supported that measure. So even if this party will sound very radical, you know, they end up, you know, supporting that measure.
And I did also want to ask you too, in one of the videos that I was watching to cut that clip, I watched as much as I could in English. I was this close because I know you're ahead of me in time, and it was 5 a.m. my time, which is like 8 yours, Camilo. I was this close to fucking sending you a message and be like, hey, can you translate this for me? Because I found some good footage of some protests, and there wasn't a translation. But what I could gather from my very, very remedial Spanish was they were saying something about, we don't want another Maduro, and we don't want to be Venezuela. Is that really part of the rhetoric of the opposition party? Like, this is our future is going to be the future of Venezuela. Let this guy stay in power.
I think this has been the narrative always. Like, even in the time of Ollantumala, there is a very mainstream Peruvian political scientist called Eduardo Darjant. Who has, you know, like a theory that I think it fits well with the reality. You know, he argues that, you know, Ollantumala that won the election in 2011 won as a center-leftist but governed as a center-rightist. So in some ways, you know, like calling a center-rightist like a Chavista was kind of, you know, like very strange. But, you know, like they try to tie anything with Venezuela. But obviously, the issue with Venezuela is that it's a petroleum economy. It was heavily dependent on petroleum. But to be honest, the entire region it's tied to commodities. That's why in 2014, the effects of the kind of the commodity price boom, you know, the end of the commodity price boom affected the entire region, even Chile, which many had the historical place for, you know, like it's not as diversified as some people will think. I think that that there is also obviously the experience of many Venezuelans, because Peru is one of the countries that holds them, one of the largest numbers of Venezuelans. Like there are 1 million Venezuelans here, and I feel it is interesting because just earlier today, I was watching the, a political analyst was being interviewed about like the elections in Lima, and he was mentioned that the two leftists that have been elected as mayor, like Alfonso Barrantes in the 80s and Susana Villarán in the 2010, were in some way center leftists. I think there has been a narrative that Peru is right wing, but I don't think Peru is necessarily that extreme. So I think, you know, to put things even more complex, like some of the factions that you know, supported the Shining Path actually come from social democracy, which is even weirder. The MSP, which was a fairly reformist party, but, you know, like, there were people that, you know, like, jumped from there to the Shining Path. Well, you know, other Maoist groups, you know, had a quite ultra-leftist take, you know, that the Shining Path were revisionists, and so it's kind of complex, you know, in some ways. Always, like, it is, like, you know, like, this, like, I do feel that there has been a sense that the left hasn't been energetic enough against the Shining Path or the revolutionary movement Tupac Amaru. And I do think that, you know, like, there had been certainly some people, individuals in particular, that had been, like, very, you know, soft, to say, in some way. But at the same time, like, Shining Path and the revolutionary movement Tupac Amaru killed a lot of leftists. So it there also had a reason to be very opposed to them. Also, like, the order of the communist parties that came from the Maoist line, Red Fireland, was very present in the teachers' union movement, and they had kind of the policy of not allowing, you know, like, Shining Path to take a hold, and I think that's curious, because in some ways, like, also Red Fireland became, like, central to the teachers union movement, and basically now they have the control of the largest teacher union organization, and curiously, like, Pedro Castillo lets a rebel teacher union in some way, like, which is a factions of different kind of organizations that you know were opposed to them, but which is curious, because, like, there were other Maoists beyond the Shining Path, like Pucallacta, which are less known and are more rural. They also oppose Shining Path, these groups, like, well, it's true that, you know, in some ways, like, the opposition to Red Fireland, you know, sometimes is from the left, to say, in some ways, other opposition from Red Fireland was from more conservative forces than them. So so Pedro Castillo, you know, like, his brief line as a union leader has been able to merge, like, different kind of you know, marginal interests in some ways. So I do feel that, you know, like, that has led to people in the margins, and you know, like, when you convoke, you know, make a call for a protest, like, the, you know, like, sometimes, you know, you don't know who could be there, and maybe someone vaguely linked to the Shining Path could be there, and so the Shining Path formally doesn't exist, but there is an organization, Moadef, who calls for an amnesty not just for members of Shining Path, but any person involved in kind of the in the conflict in the 80s and 90s, so that will include the police and the army.
Camila, I wanted to interject on a point you made. You talked about the 2014 oil shock and its effect on the politics of Peru, which is something that I, you know, for our audience, I think we should discuss in terms of the overall role of the 2004 oil shock and how it affected the left in that area. And so, if, you know, if we could elaborate on that, because you brought it up, I just wanted you to clarify exactly what that meant for the left in South America, the Pink Tide in general. Everyone else can jump in as well. Cuba, you may want to take the football on this one.
Yeah, I think that, you know, like, in some ways, like, when the entering of Lula in the 90s, but I think probably with the presidency of Hugo Chavez, who was in some ways very, very central, because, like, he there were differences, obviously, like with the style, and but in some ways, Hugo Chavez particularly ride the boom of the old prices, and in some ways, to some degree, like the commodity prices in general, and that also explains the phenomenon of Argentina, to some degree also Bolivia and Chile, even if the left in Chile was kind of more social democratic. And Uruguay is a much more complex case to explain. It's a country very, very, very particular in the sense that they do have some industrialization by the size of their economy, which is smaller, even if functional. But I do feel in the sense particular of Venezuela, there was a huge dependency of oil. And I do feel that, you know, like in many ways, like, you know, their entire project depended on the oil prices. So when prices went down, like it was kind of the start of the collapse in Venezuela. In Bolivia, it was different because like the economy, even with its limits, was more diversified. Also in Chile, it is, you know, so, you know, it's difficult to deny there is some sort of middle class, like which in some countries in Central America is very thin, like which generates some kind of expansion even in service sector, which so it was not exactly the same, but I feel that, you know, this kind of populism was not impossible to it had a lot of ties with the you know oil prices also in Ecuador. So Correa had, you know, also they have less oil than Venezuela, but also had oil, and you know, like it was important for them. And in the case of Bolivia, it was gas. So I think it was certainly important. And I do feel that, you know, like there is this right wing narrative that, you know, like kind of tries to argue that in Chile, like, you know, like Bachelet become kind of a leftist, and, you know, like Bachelet is quite moderate. Like Bachelet, like approved laws for, you know, restricting basically, you know, liberty of Mapuches, you know, like using the rhetoric of the war on terror. So I don't think, you know, like this narrative, like, you know, like it has been tried to put there, but I do feel that, you know, it is really the fact that many in the right don't want to accept, you know, like something that is real, that, you know, like the economy of Latin America is still heavily dependent on commodities, not just oil, but, you know, any country has different resources, but the complexity of this process is that, you know, like kind of there is a volatility in the economy, and now with the COVID-19 pandemic, like you see very different countries, you know, dealing with inflation, you know, like countries like Colombia were, you know, governed by a right winger, and, you know, like you have also Peru dealing with inflation, you know, and well, Argentina, like it reaches epic levels, but it is like I think in some ways, like there is some sense of continuity in some ways in the policies, with the exception of Venezuela, where you know, like it led to a different path. But I do feel that the pink wave in some way did have an effect that. In it's true that, you know, sometimes like when people say, oh, the you know, like they are kind of unwoke leftists, and to some degree, like obviously there is some true in the, you know, neither Hugo Chavez or Evo Morales or you know Rafael Correa were kind of centered on issues like gender or sexuality, but on issues like race, I think that there was a kind of different narrative. And I do feel there is a sense of representation that in some ways also, even if in Ecuador the situation is much more complex, but I feel that in some ways that plays in Peru too, because I feel that Pedro Castillo in some ways is a more representative of rural Peru, which has been you know forgotten for generations. Well, it's true that you know there hasn't been you know that much radical change in many countries that you know passed through the Pink Wave. There have been some attempts of inclusion, some.
Do we lose?
And I do feel like you know, Bolivia is quite clearly where you know like kind of the centrality now of the Aymara is it's very difficult to deny at this point. It was difficult to deny before, but it was a strong attempt by Bolivian bureaucracy. Now it's very difficult.
I want to pick up a little on the political economy of commodity prices, and then I've got a question, and then I'll hand back the football. Camilo is absolutely right. Most Latin American countries are heavily dependent on commodity exports, and this has very serious implications for the level of autonomy that governments enjoy, whether right wing or left wing, because when commodity prices are high, there is a stream of income that can be distributed, you know, either in the form of public services, social services, grants, or I think in Brazil they had the Bolsa Família, which are cash payments to poor families. And then when commodity prices drop, it doesn't matter what government you have fewer resources to distribute. You can't, if you're a right winger, you can't do tax cuts. If you're a left winger, you have to pull down on social spending in order to deal with the fact that there's just less hard currency income coming in. And this can affect advanced economies too. The oil price drop cratered the economy of the province of Alberta in Canada, and it hasn't really recovered. Mm-hmm. So the Venezuelans made the catastrophic mistake of banking in the income of high oil revenues into their spending on the regular operational spending on social services, which meant that there was no wiggle room when prices went down. And then you either have to print money, leading to hyperinflation, or you have to basically do austerity from the left. And the countries that have more forward-looking development plans, and unfortunately, if you want forward-looking development plans, you basically need to have some kind of continuity of government. I'm not saying a one-party state, but at least some autonomous economic planning within the state bureaucracy, you would spend commodity revenues on industrialization or diversification within your economy. And Chile and Argentina and some other countries, Ecuador, have built up other sectors with commodity export earnings. Interestingly, I think that part of what insulates Bolivia from this cycle is the fact that so much of the economy still remains at the village level and yep. isn't commodified, isn't marketized. So when the hard currency earnings drop, people can go back to rely on their families, a local production, and they aren't
as vulnerable. Peru have some of that too? Doesn't Peru have a lot of that too with the Andes?
It doesn't show up.
The problem with the village economy is it doesn't show up on GDP yep. measures.
It doesn't arrive.
And so in some cases, Venezuela, which has been de-villagized, right? The more and more people were shifted into the cash economy and fewer live as campesinos. That looks like a successful development story. Well, in reality, it leaves them at the mercy of fluctuations in international revenue. So that's the political economy part. What I wanted to ask Camilo was, you mentioned Vladimir Cerón He was taken down in a corruption scandal. I think he was jailed. Mm-hmm. And right now there's all these corruption allegations ongoing with Pedro Castillo. Kuczynski, the previous president, was forced to resign ahead of an impeachment vote. Mm-hmm. So what's going on with all of these corruption allegations? Is it a systemic part of Peruvian politics that if you want to win, you will engage in some illegal practices, so everyone's guilty of it? Is it a type of investigative or prosecutorial activism that if they can't beat you at the ballot box, then this is another way to kneecap your presidency or even take you down? Why is the Peruvian political system so prone to these corruption investigations and shocks?
Post Velasco, right? All this is post Velasco.
That's curious because I have a cousin who lives in Dominican Republic, and you know, like once when he was, you know, like come back from the holidays, like he was saying, you know, like in Dominican Republic, like people see Peru as an example because they are, you know, putting former, you know, like presidents in jail and things like that. And it was curious because like that was before like kind of the pandemic and everything. But I do feel that there is a lot of confluence of different things. So I do feel like Peru's economy is very informal, which means that, you know, it is curious because in some sense, like because of Peru has a large indigenous population, that makes more likely people to finish high school because they want to learn the, you know, the Spanish, because it is something valuable, particularly if someone wants to go to a city where, at least in large cities, mostly speak Spanish, even if there are a lot of you know, indigenous speakers, but a lot of them also speak Spanish. So you know, like the many times, like a lot of their, you know, like the people they trust in are not necessarily, you know, like, you know, professionals or anything, like, but just their friends or, you know, people, you know, and many times, you know, like they there is, I do feel, in many of those cases, like, you know, like less of a meritocratic, you know, but rather, you know, like try to hire a friend or, you know, like, and even in the cases of people like, you know, like Kuczynski, who was, you know, like he went to study in Oxford and in Princeton, and he worked in the US, but even him, like, trusted a very kind of close circle. And I feel that in some ways, since Peru is very informal, for politicians it's very like difficult to detect the line between what is allowed and what isn't. Because like, as I mentioned, like informality is
informal economy, formal law.
Yeah. Yeah. So that has like put, you know, like, you know, the frontiers between lobby and kind of corruption have been like very, very, in some ways, like it is so scheme, like it's basically non-existent, that the difference. And that has made even politicians who had support of the media, like, you know, to go down in investigations. The case more extreme is Alan Garcia. Alan Garcia, who was the leader of the APRA, it is a curious case because the APRA is a party that come from the left but then moved to the right. But Alan Garcia was its natural leader. He used to be a great speaker. He had, you know, like kind of lose their abilities with time, but he had been president 2 times. And when he realized, you know, he was going to go to jail, like he, you know, took his life, like he literally shot himself. And, you know, like the other cases of old former presidents are being investigated. Fujimori is in jail. Alejandro Toledo is in the U.S. and is going to be deported. Um, Ollantaytambo is also considered that he is going to be, his case could be condemned. And Kuczynski is in house arrest, and now there is an investigation of Castillo, and Cake also is an investigation because she, like, where her case is even more complex because she tried to like, you know, like kind of the money. It is a very case of using private money in her campaign, despite that, you know, like that the in some ways, like I mean, it's from different sides. I do feel that, you know, like there is an attempt to take rivals, but also there are some cases that are so ominous, like, that, you know, it's difficult to deny there is corruption there.
So I just have a very quick question. You're describing, basically, it doesn't matter whether you're a rightist or you're a leftist. If you're a former president of Peru, you're going to jail or you're going to be in exile. Mm-hmm. The question is, what is it about the legal system, the police, the judges, the prosecutors, that makes them so effective and so indiscriminate? Mm-hmm. They go after the left, they go after the right. Is there anything, you know, in Brazil, we saw a similar dynamic, but only with the left, right? They only went after Lula and the Partido do Trabajo. But in Brazil, it seems to be everybody. Do you have any insight as to why the legal system and the justice system might be this effective against former leaders?
I do think maybe there is some sense of self-selection, that the people that go for, you know, to be prosecutors in the case against corruption are people that truly want a transformation in Peru, and, you know, also think that corruption is a deep problem, and, you know, very particularly dedicated and committed, and, you know, it's you know, like, I think, you know, compared to other judges that say, you know, like, very weird, strange, even conspiracy theories, are, you know, things that don't make much logical sense. You know, when you hear, like, anti-corruption prosecutors, like, you know, you see people that, you know, like, seem competent compared to a lot of people that work in the Peruvian justice system. So in that sense, I guess that's the explanation.
So I have a question that I want to deal with the tension in the specific attempt to go after Castillo. There's a lot of tendency to read Peruvian politics, not just in the context of Latin America, but in the context of the Cold War and the post-Cold War. And there's good reasons to do this, and I'm not chastising anyone for doing it. But one of the things that I've been trying to disaggregate for years, and, you know, you know me for a long time. The only reason I know Peru very well is that, you know, I dated someone from there for a while, so that's where my knowledge base comes from. But she would always yell at me about assuming that Peruvians didn't have their own context, and that, for example, even say the racial context is unique to Peru. And that we often, in trying to force it into our woke or anti-woke narrative, or even into our Cold War narrative, did not read all the nuances of what was going on. And I say that because I want to really pull apart, like, Castillo's claim that his ethnic and class background, which for him are kind of tied together, is part of the attack on him, even from the parts of the left that seemed like they were going to abandon him at the last minute. How much of that is totally unique to the Peruvian cultural and political context, and how much of that is just BS to you know, from either side to justify what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to put the example that could sound weird, but, you know, like, Gabriel Boric, you know, like, may argue that he is very woke, but, you know, like, he got in trouble for saying, like, you know, like, apparently he had said, like, that Chilean Jews should denounce Israel. Like, you know, like, Pedro Castillo hasn't said anything remotely like that. And I think there is a quite possible explanation for that. He's from Cajamarca. And Cajamarca has been known historically as the land of the crypto Jews. Not his province per se, but in the north, like Selandín. So I do think there is this kind of sense of rejection of whiteness in a very strange way in some contexts, which has a very curious meaning, because obviously some crypto Jews do look at in the past and do look in the present as white in the Latin American context, but their identity is very different because they are as campesino. And even the term he used in his campaign was paisano, like someone who comes from rural Peru, rather than then call himself indigenous or mestizo. Like he kept this kind of ending ambiguity to some degree. I don't think in an elaborate way, because his campaign was very confused, but in some ways because the own ethnic background of Cajamarca is also complex, because like the other group that came there were the Basque, who also have their own kind of complexity within the imperial project in Latin America, and I feel that in some ways this kind of ethnic centrality is particularly because Peru has a very large indigenous population and it has a very large mestizo population, and by self-identification just 5% of the population are white, so that generates a very different political panorama. And I feel that the far right, by being soft with fascists and even Nazis, I do feel that they lose that part of the support that they could have if they weren't so tied to the more far right elements. I do feel that in some ways there is this kind of I do feel they're right in many ways by being I think in that sense, like the president of the Congress was Mari Carmen Alba, who is a white, wealthy Peruvian. There is a scene where Pedro Garcia wanted to give her hand when they, it's inaugurated, and she didn't want to give her hand. And then it was, published that she had, kind of racist, statements, and it was revealed that when she traveled to Spain, she went to Congress saying, to not recognize election, that this has been a fraud. I do think these racial dynamics are not a play in some ways, but are kind of part of the a more organic part of the political development.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask a question particularly about the racial dynamics. Has the Castillo used cultural appeals in his campaign and his politics to appeal to the indigenous populations or to the various ethnic groups in ways that other left political figures have done so? I think of Evo Morales. Who has he incorporated that into part of his politics?
And to add on to Pascal's question, I did see that there was an earthquake recently. There was a natural disaster recently in Peru, right?
Yes, that was.
And he was there. I saw him there with the people. Was it mostly campesinos that were hit?
Yes, actually, that's in the Amazon region. My father is from there. So yeah, there even if the massive fire operated, there wasn't as much casualties as I was fearing that they will be, but yeah, the a lot of towns have been destroyed. But I do feel there is a sense of identification with the population, with the more rural population, and I think that's his base of support. I think like his campaign in the first round was very smart, because he, unlike others who were on the media, like he went town to town around Peru trying to convince people, to vote for him. And I think in many sense, particularly like the rural towns, the more indigenous towns, like where, you know, much more, you know, like Peru at that point had the highest per capita debt for, you know, because of COVID-19. So it does seem for many like people don't have anything to lose in the sense that there was a you know, a very kind of complex moment at the time. And Castillo, and they saw in Castillo something that someone that reflect them and that reflect not only who they are, but their hopes. And I feel that was in some ways very representative. I do feel his rhetoric is, and I've always mentioned, you know, like the issue about, you know, saying Castillo's unwoke, but, you know, like on racial issues, I do feel that there has been a try to appeal to different communities, and not just the indigenous, but also like the Afro-Peruvians who are, which are, it's curious, the Peruvian case, they are mostly concentrated in cities, in particular in Lima, but also in Ica, in Piura. And the Asian diaspora, even like the particularly the Chinese were more larger, also even like the Japanese. I think it has been an attempt to try to reach out to different like minorities. Minorities in the case of Asian and Peruvians and Afro-Peruvians, I do feel that in political terms, generally, they have been like, although even in the case of Fujimori is kind of complex, but, you know, it's not necessarily that they are kind of that present in the narrative.
Gotcha. Go for it, Vern.
I guess I have a follow-up question about that. Is, in a lot of Latin America, the Asian diaspora community is actually associated somewhat with the right wing, and that not so superficially in the case of the former president in Peru as well. Is that generally true, or is that just, you know, like an accidental generalization? Because again, there is a tendency of Americans to read the whole world as if the whole world has our racial coalitions and complexes, and that's just not the case. So.
One of the members of the guerrilla of Che Guevara was Peruvian. I think there was a Peruvian Chinese whose surname was Chang. I do feel it's like sometimes I feel that, you know, like also the narrative also of Jews being relatively conservative, particularly like in the more recent ways, because like the crypto-Jewish memory is kind of radical in some way, but the more recent ways of Jews also being kind of more conservative, but at the same time you have in Mexico City a left-wing mayor which is Jewish, I do feel in Asian Peruvians are quite complex in the sense that for moments there have been a much more stronger identification with the indigenous populations and with the Afro-Peruvian populations, but at the same time, like they have had a, you know, social ascension, you know, in many ways they have a very kind of community tie identity which has, you know, a strong like kind of base of support, which has led to generate at this point like both a business class to some degree and a kind of professional class. So there are, you know, like many, for example, many, you know, like institutions that are kind of scientific or led by people of Asian descent. So in some ways, like there is this kind of mix that has, you know, put in some ways like the Asian diaspora more close to the to white Peruvians in levels of income and, you know, like kind of cultural elements, but at the same time there has been always this sense of difference, and I do think that is interesting.
Okay. Well, we are coming up on the end of the hour, and the sex bots have intruded in the chat. I think I got the last of them out. Someone asks Anton Dilema. Am I saying, I'm apologizing right now, Anton, if I said your name wrong. Has China been active in Peru?
It's a complex question. I do feel China, like the curious thing, there was a delegation of Popular Force, which is the party of Keiko Fujimori that went to China. You know, like Xi Jinping was condecorated when he visited. So it's curious. They had a good relationship with the right, but now like the right is kind of launching a very kind of cultural war. So now they are target of their kind of attack. So now in some ways, like I think China is kind of happy, at least rhetorically, with Castillo win, because Castillo is very pragmatic. I think in international relations, the chancellor is a moderate, and you know, he tries to have good relations with different countries. China as a model for some people in the left, I do feel that that's something that shouldn't be missed. But at the same time, I feel that obviously the fact that, you know, there has been much more recent immigration from China also paints a much more complex picture about the possibilities of, you know, like that people in China have. Because obviously, in some ways, it's easy to immigrate to Peru because there is already a large Chinese community, in some ways the largest in Latin America. But the issue is that it's still not clear what is the game of China with regard to this new pink wave, and also it's not completely clear what is the role of the U.S. in this new pink wave. I do think.
You weren't expecting that one.
is that the more you know?
That's the more you know. I meant to hit that one, the U.S. roll. I meant to hit that, and I fucked up, and I hit.
I mean, they're both kind of appropriate in a weird way, considering I associate the more you know with G.I. Joe. But
we're going into the bonus champagne room. There's no sex. There's no
champagne room.
In the champagne room. If you are a patron, get ready. The link should already be up for the patrons only champagne. If you are not a patron, boom, there you go. There's a link for that ass. You can become a patron and join us in the champagne room, where we're probably going to get Derek Varn to say really mean things about leftists that were running a victory lap on the election of Pedro Castillo, as if this was a huge win that was going to reverberate around the world, because there seems to be some complications with the Castillo administration. And one thing I do want to do in the bonus champagne room . That's what it sounds like when you leave the champagne room. That's how you feel. I want to get into these allegations. Because I save money. I don't have a lot of it. I keep it in a little bowl in my kitchen because I live alone and I feel comfortable leaving a little bit of money in a bowl in my kitchen. But I've never saved $20,000 and then hid it in my bathroom at my job.
I mean, like, you haven't lived in that case.
Or you're not at church in California.
Yeah, I mean, the thrill of office money. It's a rush, man. It's a rush.
What was it, Joel Olstein? They found like $50,000 in a bathroom?
Oh, so. Yeah. No, in a wall. It was a wall, and it was way more than $50,000.
I knew a young lady some time ago that she was in the business, and she got arrested because they found quite a bit of money in books, like hundreds of thousands of dollars in books.
So but, in books, not spent on books. Okay.
She actually should have just bought one antiquarian book worth $100,000. Because you also get appreciation. Not only that, but like if you're a hot chick going into the world of antiquarian bookselling, as long as you don't get played by the first person you talk to, they'll just be eating out of your hand, right? Like, it's also a business development opportunity. Understanding what you mean by the business correctly.
She was in the business of selling.
Mm. But not antiquarian books, which is what she should have been doing.
No, she was selling ass. But we're going to go into, we have a new outro as well. Shout out to Gene Bajlan for the new outro. Do you have anything to say to the people before we leave?
I'd like to say thank you for coming on for our return to the new year. Check us out on the Real News Network. We're going to have quite a few interesting interviews for the next few months. Please check out our first interview with Adolf Reed Jr.
I'll be cutting clips of that, and I'll be playing clips of that interview on this channel as per our contract. And Adolf Reed said some spicy things about Glenn Greenwald, and that is the first clip I will be cutting, and it will be out tomorrow. So get ready for that.
Great.
You mean our allies, like Twitter told me? Never mind, I'm gonna shut up.
See? So go to the Patreon after hours. I'm gonna look when Varn responded to me, because I felt really shitty that I wasn't gonna get you on, D. I was like, I'm hella fucked up. And I didn't know Kuba was gonna be here. I saw Kuba, I felt hella good. I was like, oh, the gang's all here. And then I was like, man, now I get to say all this shit I wanted to say. I wrote down all these fucking questions. I'm okay. You make sure you message Varn. Fuck, I'm so sorry.
That's okay. The funny thing is you tagged me as being on the show. Not like, that's why I asked to be on.
I mean, that's,
like,
that's why I thought I was invited.
I just be hoping. I'm like, man, I hope Kuba, because I was like, I don't think Kuba's free. If you ever see Kuba not in his Kuba wear, that's how you know he's like, man, I'm not fucking with y'all today. Like, all of us have, like, not, maybe not me, because I'm kind of, this is me, but there's all this clothes people wear. Or Gene. Gene and me are the same way. If we're not on the show, we're probably nude.
Please hit like and subscribe.
We are out. Oh! And tell me what you guys think of this new outro that Gene Bajlan did. Put together, music by me.